AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Viewer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns, and we welcome you guys back to talk about the aftermath of yet another road game abomination as your Golden Gophers travel into the track capital of the United States, that is Eugene, Oregon, and the track stars on a dry surface compared to the one they played in the week before in Iowa City. The Jimmies and Joes looked like they were much better than Minnesota's in a 42-13 victory for the number 8 team in the country. A Gopher defense that does not force a punt while these starters are in. A Gopher defense that continues to be a wet paper bag against the pass on the road. A Gopher offense that cannot run into negative boxes or keep their quarterback upright in 7-man protections. So much to get into from what was, for those of you who traveled out there, I thought an incredible game day experience out there in Eugene and Autzen and everything in between. But joining us as he does for every Big Ten game, my second cousin, former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, Derek Burns. Derek, how are things for you today?
I'm doing well, guys. I appreciate you having me back. Win or lose, I enjoy talking college football, so excited to get into it.
All right, yeah, let's get into it. The Gophers lost 42-13. Go through some counting stats here real quickly. We can start with the Gopher offense. On the day, the Gophers scored 13 points, as I noted. They had 200 yards of total offense, 138 passing, and only 62 rushing. They ended up with 13 total first downs. Their third down efficiency was 7 of 16, and they were 1 of 1 on fourth down. On the day, Drake Lindsey was 19 of 32 for a touchdown. He wasn't awesome. He wasn't terrible. He amassed 138 yards, as we noted earlier. The running game, in general, if you look, there's 24 carries for 62 yards, but Darius Taylor had 10 for 57 and a 5.7 yard average. Femi had 3. Cam Davis had 4. Neither eclipsed 4 yards per carry. You did see Coy Parrish sprinkle in a little bit, probably most we've seen since the non-conference season. Ended up with 2 carries for 11 yards. I think the thing that my takeaway of this offense was they definitely went and said, hey, we're going to kind of throw the kitchen sink in terms of formations, in terms of conceptual stuff, even in terms of ball handling. But at the end of the day, the defensive line for Oregon was definitely phenomenal. And this Gopher offensive line just wasn't really able to handle it, Derek. So what was Oregon trying to do to stop the Gophers, or what did they do to stop the Gophers?
Well, this was yet another game where the opposing team chose to play mostly man coverage. And I think if we just, we've talked about this in previous weeks, but maybe slow down and get into it here a little bit more. Why is that happening? I think there's 3 reasons why teams are electing to play man. Number one is Drake Lindsey's been really good against zone coverage. So, you know, they look at the film, they see where Minnesota's, you know, passed the ball well, where they've struggled, et cetera. That's the first thing. The second is Minnesota's wide receivers are struggling, as Ryan has pointed out, to win contested catches downfield. They're not drawing pass interference. They're not, and that's one of the ways you punish opposing defenses that play man coverage. You try and identify single coverage downfield, get chunk plays out of it. Minnesota's not doing that. And then the third and final reason, I think, is that Drake is not a running threat. So one of the things you look for when a team's playing man coverage is if they don't leave a spy or a linebacker in to stay with the quarterback, you can run four verticals, three verticals, and then scramble the quarterback. And that's just not Drake's game. Now, if you don't have that skill, you can rely more on the screen game, which Minnesota has. I think the play calling was quite creative in this game. I do have to give him some credit for that. But again, that's, you know, the opponents have film just the same way that Minnesota does. And Oregon really leaned heavy into man coverage. And then, you know, on the flip side, the running game, man coverage should also open up some things there. But it just was a struggle. And as you mentioned, Luke, a mismatch on the defensive line. I think this defense had more team speed than Ohio State and more than any other team that Minnesota has faced this year. I don't know that they're better than Ohio State as a team, but as far as speed and athleticism, I think this was the best they faced.
So the entire front row of the press box, or at least in front of me is the road media, was NFL scouts. So myself, the curious man that I am, I went down there before the game just to kind of ask around about like what they thought about Anthony Smith. And I also went, how many of these guys on the Oregon defense, because I knew the Oregon defense was good. The Oregon defense, I'll remind everybody, was the number two defense in all of college football. The Gophers have now played the number one, that is Ohio State, the number two, that is Oregon, and the number seven going into last week's game, that was the Iowa Hawkeyes. Oh, good for them. And that's where I had a couple NFL scouts actually literally show me that 10 of the 11 guys on Oregon's defense have draftable NFL grades. Like, that is a Jimmy's and Joe problem compared to necessarily an X's and O's problem, which I think you saw the offensive coordinator, Greg Harbaugh, he knew that, which is why you saw every different formation he could think of thrown at them, because Minnesota just cannot line up and beat them. Now, I would also tell you, I think this was arguably the worst performance I've seen execution-wise from the Minnesota Moving Company up front. And before I say anything more, because I just feel like it falls on deaf ears, yet if my second cousin says it, everybody listens. We've talked about the offensive line, and they were just overmatched. And I think this is the best, and I'll put the disclaimer on it, I think this is the best defensive line they played all year. But when the offensive line has five guys blocking four guys, so there's an unblocked, like there is a Gopher offensive lineman available to help, and they're just, Drake Lindsey's dead within 2 seconds of taking the snap, Derek. Here's how I want to pose the question to you. You played offensive line at this fine institution. You are one of the smartest offensive line minds I've ever met, as I continue to gas you up here. You've watched a lot of Gopher offensive line play. Where does this 2025 season rank for you for offensive line play in the Fleck era?
Well, I appreciate the compliment.
The truth cannot be controversial, Dave. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we talked about this earlier. I think it was after the Ohio State game. I think, first of all, from a physicality standpoint, unfortunately, I think this is a low point in the Fleck era. I don't really remember PJ's first season very well. So as I'm racking my, dusting the cobwebs off my brain here, I think it's probably a low point in the Fleck era in terms of execution. If I think back to, which I don't like to do, but if I try to think back to the offensive lines that struggled the most, probably the Brewster years, particularly, you know, a few of those in there, I think were worse, but this is definitely, Ryan, I mean, the numbers show it. It's unfortunately, it's down there. And I think
a low point in physicality is the thing that struck my ears, and I'm sure it struck many of them. So I'm going to try to be a good journalist and media member and follow up with you on that and say, I agree with you, but that's kind of the crux of this thing with the offense is Greg Harbaugh. Again, I continue to say this every week and people still don't listen. The blame game pie for the offense includes the offensive coordinator. But if we're going to be cutting out chunks of the pie here, that statement from Derek is the one that resonates truest with me, where if you just don't have any knockback up front on your offensive line in the Big Ten, I mean, what are we even talking about then at that point, Derek?
Yeah, and so the physicality really hasn't been there. Now, what we've talked about is this has been a pretty athletic offensive line. They can move, they can pull. The pass blocking for 3 out of 5 of them has been pretty decent. But Friday, they could not match up athletically. That's a Jimmy's and Joe's issue, as you've pointed out, where if you're two best, I mean, particularly Minnesota's left guard, left tackle, they've been able to match up athletically with just about any team, and it was a mismatch on Friday. And that's just, that's a bad sign when your two best linemen aren't able to to match the speed and athleticism of Oregon. Now, what I would say, Ryan, play calling wise, I would agree with you. Mm-hmm. I thought the play calling was creative. We saw multiple sets, multiple formations, multiple screens, etc. The one area I would criticize, though, is some of the run play calling I don't get. I mean, they're still trying to run inside zone out of 12 personnel, which is 2 tight end. It hasn't worked all year. And if you see when they have success running the ball, which is few and far between, it's almost always either a gap scheme or some sort of unconventional play call or formation or personnel. You know, Darius Taylor's long run in this game, which unfortunately was called back with the holding. I mean, that was a unique, creative play call. So it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is when they get away from inside zone out of 2 tight end, the more they get away from that, the better it looks. So the only criticism I would have in play calling is they need to stop going back to that. And if it's one of those, I'm just guessing here, but yep, if it's one of those things where, well, we need to go back to inside zone, we need to work on it. We're not working on it at this point. We don't have the bandwidth to run the ball 30, 40 times a game to develop an inside zone game. We're not there. It's not going to happen. So yeah, that's, and you're right. It puts you in a corner when defenses are able to play even in the box or even -1, which is God, incredible to think about.
Don't get me started. Okay.
Because then they can put more safeties back. They can put more coverage, which makes it harder on your passing game, harder on your receivers. It just, everything turns upside down. You're literally running uphill at that point.
So I think I agree with you on that. It's 12 personnel running into inside zone. But that's where I come back to. That is the run game coordinator, who's also the offensive line coach's bread and butter for the last 9 years. That's what Minnesota has recruited offensive linemen to do. Is you look at Brian Callahan's high school recruiting, they want to be, I think, as Brewster used to put it back in those years, kind of more of a mass kicks ass type of offensive line. Now, I would argue you need to get as athletic as you need. Like, that to me was the glaring thing, and I'm glad you brought it up, Derek, was like your left tackle and Nathan Roy and your left guard and Greg Johnson are the two most athletic guys you have on the line. And when they're getting out-athleted, that tells you everything you need to know. I also think if we're being fully honest here, I think Nathan Roy would probably tell you that was his worst start as a Gopher, which is liable to happen in a road game in Oregon against the freaks of nature that they have. He wasn't particularly good, had some penalties, or even I think about from the first offensive play where the Gophers try to drag Drew Bibber across the line. He gets shoved 4 yards into the backfield and hits Drew Bibber as he's trying to come across. And instead of what would have been a 10-plus yard gain in the flat, it's 4 yards because Bibber gets annihilated backwards. But they just don't run gap because I don't think it's taught in the offseason, honestly, where this is an offense. It's an offensive line that wants to run inside, mid, and outside zone. Look, I want to do a lot of things in life, to be clear here, but I know what my strengths are, and I would like to go with my strengths, not my weaknesses, like many of you. And so that is the perplexing thing for me, is why does Harbaugh continue to call those things? Is it because that's what they worked on for 9 months? Because that's what they want to run? Because I agree with you, Derek. I'd run more gap. I'd try to do anything to try and get Darius Taylor the ball, who Darius leads the team in rushing, 10 carries for 57 yards. A lot of that was that 23-yard scamper on the draw call, but he even led the team with 9 receptions. You saw them do everything to try and get Darius Taylor the ball to try and move it. So I just think with the offensive line, and we try to be a solutions-driven podcast here, the why of where they are in the offensive line, whereas Derek noted, he thinks is probably the least physical offensive line in the 9 years of Fleck, which that's a statement in itself. I think to me, and I wrote about it this week, and I've talked about it on GopherIllustrated.com, is it's empty high school recruiting classes. What do I mean? you go back 5 years. So the guys that should be redshirt seniors in college, Minnesota took three high school linemen. None of them are here and none of them played. You look at the fourth year guys, guys such as Ashton Beers, who's now starting at center for Minnesota, started for them last year. He's the only hit from that class. Tony Nelson, they refuse to play in a meaningful capacity still. Cade McConnell is now starting a guard for Vanderbilt, and the fourth member of that class transferred out, never played. You look at the 23 recruiting class that features Greg Johnson. He's a hit. So is Ashton Beers. Guess what? No one else from that class is a hit. Jerome Williams tore his Achilles, and he's not the same player. Philip Daniels is no longer here, and he's starting at Ohio State. So for whatever the reason is, and between those three recruiting classes, I believe they took 12 high school linemen. If you can only point to 3, 4, and 5 years later combined that two of them are hits, that's the problem. Because I know what they can afford in the portal. I'm watching it start at right guard and right tackle. Plus, they have dead money with Khalid Tafai that they just refuse to play for whatever the reason. Plus, Jaden Ball doesn't play. I mean, you have, for a school that has finite resources, and we, Lord knows, we've spent so much time talking about those finite resources on this podcast, you cannot afford to have significant money not playing because you only have a finite budget at certain spots. And for you to whiff both with the guys that are playing and the guys that aren't playing, because that's the statement in itself that Fleck and Callahan and Harbaugh continue to trot out there, is I hear what you say, trust what you do. It's one of the things that my father taught me at a young age and something I use and translate to my job. Is I hear that they acknowledge it's a problem, but I see that they believe they're playing the best five linemen that they have. The scary part is, what if that's true? Like, what if the guys behind them aren't as good in practice? Because I know looking forward here that Drake Lindsey is got to be looking at his offensive line. And for those of you who rewatched the game or watched it live, I know there was a sack where the right tackle gets beat. Drake Lindsey is on the floor. And NBC, or who was it, BTN?
Fox.
Shows as they're coming off the field, Drake is ripping the offensive lineman. It's clear that Drake Lindsey is getting antsy. In the pocket, he's throwing off his back foot a lot more. He's starting to, and this was the worry, he's starting to get David Card a little bit, where he's starting to see ghosts. He's not stepping into throws. I think his accuracy is errant because of it. So how do you fix this going forward into 26? I mean, that's a whole different podcast that I think we should do in December with the offensive line guru that is Derek Burns, Luke. But if you want the offense to be better, and we all acknowledge the offense stinks, but the thing that, and I wrote about it too in my takeaways, and agree or disagree with me, Luke, the things that they have to do scheme-wise to just get 4 yards, this is as hard as I've seen, like, the scheme have to work to get 4 yards, because they just can't line it up and say we're better than you in many of these road games right now, or even just in the Big Ten in general. Everything has to be, it's just, they have to work so hard to get 4 yards. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I think I agree. There's an element, too, where the players, when given the opportunity, aren't executing. And some of that comes on the offensive line. It is, we've talked about a lot through the years, being able to execute and complete a forward pass takes many working parts working in tandem and something not failing for it to be successful. The offensive line is culpable for that as well. If you go back to this game, I do think that the game plan wasn't terrible, especially early when you saw the Gophers seeing that man coverage, throwing into man coverage, something I don't think they typically have done a lot, especially taking shots. You know, they didn't get a couple of pass interference calls early. it is what it is. And then you can see the coaching staff go irate. They eventually do get a couple of those, calls. And ultimately those are critical in terms of being able to have one of their best drives. And that drive that I'm referring to is the 13 play 67 yard drive that took seven minutes and 6 seconds off the clock for the second field goal. Right. You have two pass interference calls there. So that's one thing. At the end of the day, you know, the other thing that we probably have to acknowledge, and we're not talking about more broadly, is that offensive line play in general, not just for the Gophers, just in college football, is poor, right? This isn't a unique thing to Minnesota. Well, my kid has to go pooper, so now I have to help him with that. I don't know if everybody caught that.
That was the horrible time for me to take a sip of coffee. I damn near spit it on my screen.
Ryan, once again, we need to talk about our partners at Blue Horizon Energy. And we talked about previously that, honestly, energy prices are just growing rapidly. They're growing faster than the rate of inflation. If you look at their projections going into 2030, that the increase could be anywhere between 28 and 46%. It could be between 15, almost 16 cents to 18 cents. That's more than triple the cost in 2003. Ryan, the only way that you could get ahead of this if you're a grower or a business operator is to invest in renewable energies like solar array panels, like what Blue Horizon Energy installs.
Look, I know we have a lot of listeners on this podcast, and we love each and every one of you, but we know there's plenty of you in the ag community or in the commercial businesses. And energy, as Luke said, is only going up. So where can people go if they're trying to find a way to lower their cost, Luke?
If you want to learn more about ways to be able to save on those rising energy costs, go to bluehorizonenergy.com/gridiron, fill out the form, and they will get in touch with you. Again, that is bluehorizonenergy.com/gridiron. Well, after that impromptu break, we're back. This is where I was talking a little bit about where I think that offensive line play in general is actually down in college football across the board. I don't know, Derek, I'd be curious to get your thoughts, you know, given your experience playing offensive line.
Yeah, I think offensive line play is down in college and the NFL. I don't pay enough attention to high school football. Maybe, Ryan, maybe you can confirm or deny, but it is. There, I think a couple things. Players are, or athletes are playing younger. So the old school develop an offensive lineman, sees his first snap in his redshirt sophomore or third year. Those days are over, and just, you know, playing younger, more undeveloped bodies at that position is going to lead to more mistakes. So that's, I think, part of it. I also think that there's such an emphasis now in youth football in the 7-on-7 part, which is, you know, just that voids offensive linemen. It's just wide receivers and defensive backs and the quarterback. And I think there's evidence for that because the passing and catching game, to me, has never been better. I mean, you're looking at some of these catches you're seeing in college and the NFL that 10 years ago, I mean, I think like Odell Beckham Jr. had the miraculous. You see that every week now. It's unbelievable. I mean, so parts of the game, particularly the passing and some of the development there has never been better all the way down into college and high school. But unfortunately, line play, I think, has gotten worse. And I also wonder, too, I just totally speculating, if the numbers aren't there, the number of kids playing youth football at the line position are down, which then, again, lowers your supply and just, it's an issue. So it's not just Minnesota. This is an issue we're seeing, I think, nationwide.
All right. Other things to talk about in the offense, just to kind of close up the offense on the touchdown. It was awesome to see them run that same play again that they ran against Ohio State and actually have success. Complete the ball, a good adjustment by Tracy to make the catch.
I'll say it was a bad ball. Yeah. But Tracy made a better.
They still executed. It was better by Tracy, but that is one, a very clever play, and one that they were able to scheme up and actually get the touchdown. That was awesome. I don't know. We could talk about the other touchdown drive too, but just you see some improvement there. But at the end of the day, it's not. There's just not enough consistent. There's not enough consistent execution or consistent success for this offense.
Yeah, you even saw Coy Parrish play a season high in snaps in the Big Ten offensively. I think he played 5 snaps, got a couple of carries. I'm watching Coy Parrish go into orbit motion to run the option with Drake Lindsey, which is where they're currently at as a rushing offense, because they can't line up and beat you up front. Or even, I think about one of the other plays that's going to stick out to me is, so Drake reads it correctly in this play, where the corner blitzes from the Oregon sideline, and Minnesota has a bubble set up to Logan Loya, where it's 2-on-2 in space. All right, if your receiver who's out there makes the block, all Loya has to do is make a man miss, and then he's off to the races. And the effort that is shown in trying to be physical there, it reminded me of a Matador. And Logan Loya gets hit at the line of scrimmage because of it. It just, this offense is what it is at this point, with physicality on the outside, with physicality in the trenches. And it gets easier the next 2 weeks for the 11 a.m. kick at Wrigley, when what is going to be an absolute abomination of a field. If you watched any of the Northwestern game against Michigan, you saw the field start to get torn up. And I know we've already got the weather terrorist mad at Luke and I, because we talked about how it was going to rain 72 hours out and then it didn't rain. And I know some of you got all hot and bothered about it. Welcome to meteorology, where they get to be right 20% of the time. But if you look at the upcoming Chicago forecast, there is multiple days leading into that Wrigley game where it's just rain. And that field is going to be not great. It's already not great, and now you're going to put a couple of days of rain on it before you run out there. I know that we have Gopher people in that building listening to this. Let me make the proclamation now here early in the week. I speak on behalf of all three of us when I say this. Hey, equipment staff, let's put the high little, you know, the high cleats on for this one, because I don't want to see all these Gophers slipping out there in what is going to remind many of you of what we've seen from, say, the Guaranteed Rate Bowl, where they opened the stadium in a rain inexplicably right before, and that field was an abomination. The Pinstripe Bowl, who can forget that one, where they're slipping and sliding? Make sure the cleats are right if Minnesota's going to be able to win that football game.
Do you think that the Gophers have as much in-baseball experience as Northwestern now? Like in baseball stadium experience. About
you say that, I'd learned Northwestern has never won at Wrigley Field.
Oh, weird.
They've played now, I think, 4 games over the last 3 seasons there, and some of it's because they're building that new stadium, and now they're also playing their early games at the Mistake by the Lake, that practice facility type of deal. But I think, yeah, well, it's probably a lot closer than what people think because of the Guaranteed Rate, because of the Pinstripe. I mean, it is interesting. So you hope that the equipment staffs are ready for this, because I'm telling you, it is going to be the worst playing surface you will see all season.
All right. Anything else you guys want to talk about on offense, and then we'll take our normal break?
I just like that they use Darius in about every creative way. And we kind of buried the lead that Darius Taylor did return, as we talked about in the preview episode. He looked healthy to me, and they tried to do everything they could to scheme him the ball in different ways. They're going to have to continue to do so, because he's clearly your best skill position player. And I would love nothing more. And I know that some people are upset that, look, in this world where everybody's just upset all the time, well, Ryan, Darius only got the ball 14 times. You know, what the hell? Excuse me. Well, he led the team in targets, led the team in rushing attempts. What else do you want them to do when they're not running the football consistently? His best rush is a well-timed draw call that he nearly slips through and gets housed. I mean, he led the team in targets too. That's going to be the recipe for Darius Taylor these next 2 weeks against Northwestern and Wisconsin. Scheme him against what is not going to be out athletes on the Northwestern linebacking core or the Wisconsin linebacking core. Like, this isn't Zach Bond and what is it, TJ Orr? From back in the day that is roaming around Wisconsin's linebacking core. Find ways to get Darius Taylor the football in space, and this offense will then move the ball because of it.
Yeah, my final comment on offense is I think they should just continue to be unconventional at this point with the play calling and the formations and the motions. I think there was some positive outcome on that. Again, didn't show up on the scoreboard, but the screen game that they brought in the second half, things like that. Like Ryan said, you are who you are at this point, and I think they've had more success being creative in some of those things. And it's also a scouting thing for the other team. You know, you introduce some new concepts and or at least a lot of concepts to give them something to have to game plan for. That becomes more of a challenge. So I'd like to see him just continue to be creative and unconventional on offense these last couple games.
Yeah, yeah, should be interesting. The offenses are going to play two of probably the more improving defenses in the last two games. So, all right, let's catch a quick break and then we'll come back and talk defense. Ryan, I don't know if you noticed, but all of a sudden it's already November, and you know what that time is. It's open enrollment time. So while you're thinking about life insurance, or I shouldn't say life insurance, health insurance, looking at maybe making a change there, you know, this is a good time to also think about your auto, home, life, all maybe your ATV insurance, boat insurance, and the Burns Insurance Agency can help you shop during that open enrollment period.
I mean, absolutely. And that's where the independent insurance agent himself, that is the Burns Insurance Agency, located in lovely downtown Oakdale, Minnesota. For myself as a client, I've talked about this story before, but we had a hailstorm come through here in Roseville. And initially when the adjuster came out, he told me to go shove it, that there wasn't enough damage. Well, guess what? My insurance agent came out with our own roofing people, took the quality photos, said, nah, we're not going to shove it. And I got a brand new roof out of it for only my deductible. And it's because my insurance agent puts in the extra effort. You're not just a number on a spreadsheet. Or even, I love to tell the story last year of Austin coming up to me on Oak Street before the Gopher game and saying, hey, he and Tina, they saved you $700. Appreciate it. Well, he found me here just a few weeks ago. Guess what? They switched him to a different insurance here in 2025, saved him $1,000. On his home and auto. That is the beauty of an independent insurance agent. They're not loyal to anyone except their client, which is you. So if you want to give them a shout today, shoot them an email, bill@insurancebyburns.com, or check them out online, insurancebyburns, all one word, .com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
All right, we're back. Let's chat about the Gopher defense. This is going to be a tough conversation, but one we're going to have. On the day, the Gophers give up 42 points. If you look at Oregon passing, they were 30 for 33. Dante Moore himself was 27 for 30. I believe that was an Oregon record. He threw for 306 yards in total, and I mean, had two touchdown passes. If you look at the rushing, you know, they had two guys that averaged over 8 yards a carry. That's never a good formula for success. They rushed it 30 times for 179 yards. And then you look at, like, the matchup nightmare. This is one of the rare teams in the Big Ten that actually runs a true spread. And they're definitely going matchup hunting, and they are matchup hunting for Kenyon Sadiq. He had 8 catches for 96 yards and a touchdown. He was just phenomenal. He was kind of a one-man wrecking crew for them. The Gophers struggled in this game to consistently find ways to get a stop, and that manifested in never having a punt for Oregon. They did, though, Ryan, as much as you begged.
It punt in the fourth quarter.
Oh, did they? Oh, I missed
that. Well, that's after they pulled the starters, but that's going to be my point here. I'll let you finish first.
Yeah, yeah. But they did. They were finally able to amass a takeaway, so I have to imagine you were happy about that. That was
the pants came off at the Eugene press box. Thank you.
All in all, a tough day for the Gopher defense. This is probably the kind of matchup that is worse for them than I could even formulate in my head. Derek, but curious what you saw and how Oregon was trying to attack this Gopher defense.
Well, Minnesota went against their norm this game. I would have to venture to guess Minnesota hasn't played more than 20% of snaps in zone coverage in any game up to this one. And they flipped that in this game. I think they were probably 75-80% zone coverage. Why was that? Minnesota wanted nothing to do with trying to match up outside with multiple Oregon wide receivers and man coverage. So I think it was probably the right decision. However, this was a heck of a game to try and knock the rust off your man coverage, excuse me, off your zone coverage, which hasn't been good the whole year. And so Minnesota running, they tried to run more zone pressures in the first half. And I have to give some credit. Oregon really is in the pass game, really responded well to those pressures, probably better than just about any other team. And so that kind of took Minnesota out of their pressures. In the second half, they were dropping 7 and 8 into coverage. And unfortunately, they were still not able to get a pass breakup, a stop, things like that, with even dropping 7 or 8 into coverage. And it's one of those things where you bring in the Jimmies and Joes of Oregon, and let's say you drop 7 into coverage, you're going to cover things deep. I mean, that's, you're not going to let anything up the seam. But when Oregon checks down against zone coverage, if it were any other team, that's a 4-yard completion. Well, in Oregon, it's an 8-yard completion because they have so much speed. They can check down to a slot or an outside receiver on a short route, catch the ball. They're going to make one or two guys miss in space because they're just that good, and get an 8-yard gain. So when their check down's an 8-yard gain, it's going to be a long day for the Gopher defense. So passing wise at that, and I think, you know, the completion percentage says it all. You know, I think they, Ryan, did they not set a school record or stadium record or something for completion percentages? You know, they were very, incompletions were few and far between, and I think that was mainly a factor of Minnesota's zone coverage.
So let me just list to you the amount of quarterbacks that have been drafted over the years from the University of Oregon, just to, number one, make Luke Buehr angry for his Washington Husky fandom, but also to drive home the point here. Marcus Mariota was the second overall pick. Derek's favorite Detroit Lions quarterback, Joey Harrington, went third overall. Justin Herbert was sixth. Bo Nix was 12th. Who could forget Sun Bowl legend Kellen Clemens as a second-round draft pick? Dylan Gabriel. I mean, I can continue to go down the list here. Akili Smith convinced the NFL he was worthy of the third overall selection. Yet it was Dante Moore, without his top two receivers, who sets an Oregon single-game completion record on Friday night. I mean, he was, number one, he's a five-star for a reason. And so him going 27 of 30, 90% completion percentage for 306 yards and 2 touchdowns. It's not that part that necessarily bothers me, is going to be my point to you, is it bothers me that he did that without his top two receivers, because Kenyon Sadiq is a freak and they still got freak athletes. My worry here is it continues the trend that Minnesota's pass defense and road games has more holes in it than the Swiss cheese sandwich I'm going to eat this afternoon. Like, to drive home this point, the Gopher pass defense on the road, ladies and gentlemen, all you handsome and beautiful people out there, prepare yourselves, because it's going to be jarring, is allowing 82% completion percentage from opposing starting quarterbacks. 82 in 4 road games, and they're averaging 266 passing yards with 9 touchdowns and no turnovers. I mean, that'd be an MVP. They're turning these quarterbacks into MVPs. And look, Dante Moore is probably going to be a top 60 selection when he comes out. Same thing with Julian Sand. We'll see what JKS ends up being at Cal, and then Mark Gronowski even got it done enough against them. They've played some talented quarterbacks, so I'd be remiss if I don't include that. But the way that they just continue to allow opposing passing games to do whatever they want is the worrisome trend. Derek touched on it. They tried something different going more zone. They stink at zone. They can't get pass breakups. Their zone drops aren't perfect. You saw it from the opening Oregon drive, where there's a coverage bust between Zaquan Bryan, who thinks they're in cover two, with Coy Parrish over the top. Yet Coy Parrish's eyes are in the backfield until he sees out of his peripherals that there's a streaking Oregon receiver right there, where if it's a better throw, it's a walk-in touchdown. or even the Kenyon Sadiq one that gets them to the 1 yard line, the better touchdown or a better throw. That's a touchdown as Matt Kingsbury gets shed at the line of scrimmage and then no one's there. It's just these coverage busts, man. And that's the thing that bothers me is, yeah, Oregon's got the Jimmys and Joes, but it was the X's and O's of coverage busts and guys not in the right spots at times. So let me keep it there, Derek. I mean, I think about those two specific plays off the rip there. Why do you think that they were having as many busts as they were having? Because you don't complete 90% of your passes without something going wrong defensively.
Well, their zone, to just dive into the zone coverage here for a second, two things that I noticed in the rewatch. So if you were to say, okay, Minnesota's not very good at zone, what's going on? Why is that? Well, I think, number one, the linebackers aren't getting enough depth on their zone drops. So the middle of the field between the linebacker and the safeties becomes wide open. Now, this is a classic, if you're going to attack zone, that is definitely one of the areas you target because it's hard to defend. Well, the Minnesota linebackers aren't getting drops because they are concerned and committed first and foremost to stopping the run. So they're not getting quick enough and enough depth in the middle of the field. And then the other issue is on the outside, the cornerbacks have not this whole year done a good job passing off from shallow to deep. So in a zone, traditionally on the outside, your corner has the flat area and he stays with the outside receiver until they get to a certain point, and then he passes that off to the safety and he has to recover and defend the flat. That's an acquired skill. It's not necessarily an athleticism thing. It's just a repetition, and you have to learn how to recognize that and do that quickly. And the Minnesota corners aren't there, so they're getting too much depth on the outside, which leaves the outside flats wide open for these underneath, you know, 8, 10, 12, 9-yard passes on the outside. So you saw that over and over again, and you know, again, this is something that they have to either rep and work on and get more experience, or they just have to decide to play less zone. I would say this too, interesting comment here, game theory observation. Last week, Oregon played at Iowa. Iowa's defense had similar difficulties matching up with Oregon and their speed on the outside, which is unusual because Iowa obviously is 2-3 defense in the Big Ten. In the second half, Iowa made the game theory decision to take their safeties out of run defense and put them outside on pass defense. So in other words, they said, you're not going to pass the ball on us. You can run the ball, but you're not going to beat us on the outside passing. And what happened was Oregon ran all over them. I think it was 250 plus yards, but it took them longer to score. It was this game of attrition that Iowa likes to bait opposing teams into. Like, yeah, fine, we're going to let you run, but you're going to have to put together 12, 14 play drives. And effectively, that was a one-score game. Now, Iowa ended up losing, but it was a one-score game. Minnesota did the opposite in this game. And I'm not suggesting one choice is right and one is wrong, but Minnesota definitely committed to stopping the run. There were zone pressures. They chose to run zone in the first place in large part to stop Oregon's run. And they did pretty good job at that, especially in the first half. I liked the physicality of Minnesota's front seven against the run. But the issue that creates is it makes it very difficult to defend play action, especially against some of the talent that Oregon has on the outside. So you have to pick your poison, and unfortunately, when you play a team with as much team speed as Oregon, sometimes even their second, third, or fourth options are still going to beat you.
Well, I also want to give Luke credit here, because other than being an outstanding co-host and a very handsome man, he's right when he talked about in the group chat that I feel like, and I'll ask you, Derek, because I know Luke's thoughts, and I know I'm taking words out of his mouth here. It felt like you look at the poor angles at times or even the missed tackles, and we'll get into the refereeing in this game, which was just, it's going to warrant its own segment. It was that polarizing, but it felt like Minnesota is now pressing to get takeaways. they had come into the game without a takeaway in their last three games, and they get a takeaway in this game thanks to Will Stein on 3rd and 15, Will Stein being the offensive coordinator for Oregon, deciding to call a tunnel screen that is going to be a flip to a running back coming the other direction, and it's horribly executed. Carter Menz falls on it, and the Gophers get a takeaway. You don't get to take away the takeaway because they didn't do anything to earn it. I mean, I'd argue that they've had some bounces not go their way, which plays part in it. But the point I'm trying to make here is, you think about that touchdown run that's fumbled in the end zone twice. Well, why is he in the end zone? It's because Gopher secondary members, one of them is trying to rip the ball out the entire time and not get him down. There's a safety who comes in and just throws a shoulder. And then you think about the Kenyon Sadiq one where he's ruled down by his helmet. Well, there's a Gopher secondary member that doesn't try to get him down on the ground. He's just punching at the football. Do you think that they are now just pressing to get the turnover, the takeaways, because they know they're not coming organically, and it's clearly being, I have no issue with it being taught the way that it is, but this is the other side of the coin where if you're not going to get the takeaway, it's either a 100th percentile outcome or a 0th percentile outcome in situations like that. Do you hear what I'm trying to put down?
Yeah. First of all, I agree. I do think that that was a strategy. I do think it bit them, particularly on that running touchdown you talked about. And I don't really have a problem with it. Let's be honest, guys. If you're a coaching staff before this game and you're putting together a game plan, you really are thinking Minnesota, in order to win the game, if you're going to beat Oregon at a night game on a Friday night, you're probably going to have to be at least +2 and take give. I mean, apart from that, barring that, you're going to have to play perfect. They're going to have to play terrible. It's just the way it is in you know, with these two teams, with the personnel that we've talked about over and over. So, well, how do you do that? Well, you have to dial up the risk reward, and you're going to have to risk giving up some touchdowns and chunk plays to try and get more minus plays and more turnovers. I think they did that. I think Luke's right. And, you know, it didn't pay off for him. But what are you going to do if you go in and say we have to be +2? You have to have a strategy to try and achieve that.
Yeah. And I guess from my standpoint, like, it's one thing to say, like, hey, we need turnovers and take that as a strategy. I don't disagree that it's probably the right strategy to take. I think the challenge is for most fans, you've seen that the Gophers have struggled to tackle a lot of the year, and then you've kind of exacerbated that on a very visible national stage by going and trying to force those turnovers, and then you tackle poorly, and then you have the bobbled, possessed, then fumbled once again touchdown, that where it's like kind of jaw dropping. You're like, how did they not make that tackle? Well, because they're trying to get the strip. I don't know. I think it's hard to rationalize both can be true. One, the Gophers are not a great tackling team, and two, if they're going to win, you have to be able to force turnovers. And the reality is that it just exposes you. And that's what we saw in this specific game. The other reality is that, you know, the defense gave an option to Oregon, as Derek pointed out, and they were able to execute on it consistently in the pass game. And that's the fun of the chess match of these matchups. It's maybe not the approach I would have taken, but I can understand why Collins went that direction.
Yeah, I also want to get Derek's thoughts on a few things here secondary-wise. Is, first of all, they'd be sunk without John Nestor.
Yep.
What he has largely brought to them it's very noticeable when he's not on the field, because Zaquan Bryan is banged up again, was not on the injury report after missing the game against Michigan State, where he gets injured in warmups because of a shoulder injury. It looked like early in that game against Oregon, he re-injured that shoulder. And if there's ever anybody who can tell you about shoulder injuries, it'd be my big, dumb ogre self. Those can be very tricky if you're dealing with stability issues, which it looked like he was, because then he was not dressed to come out the second half. So I think his availability for next week in Wrigley and certainly the end of the season is very much in doubt. But he was projected to be your starting corner. He was the most experienced starting corner returning on the roster. and now he's banged up. Mike Gerald finally made his return from a soft tissue injury. I think there's going to be ups and downs of playing a redshirt freshman. And then when your other best corner is Jayonte McMillan, who the story is great, where he's a former walk-on at TCU, earns his way into special teams, hits the portal. The Gophers take him to be a nickel, and now he's had to play a lot of outside corner, and I think he's played largely well there. But it's just been a war of attrition out there with injuries and different things of that. So this is a long-winded way of me getting to what I know people want Derek to talk about, which is Coy Parrish. Look, he is a very polarized. He's the most popular player on the team. And I don't think any of the three of us would disagree that there has been a sophomore slump aspect to Coy. Now, I also don't think that's necessarily all on Coy. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm sure many of you are thinking, here we go, Ryan's making excuses again. Well, part of why I don't think you're seeing Coy make as many of these game-changing plays that you think about that he did last year is because his defense is actually getting home on the quarterback. The Gophers came into that Oregon game leading the Big Ten in sacks. Well, if there had just been pressures and say you take 10 of those sacks away and they just become errant throws in the air, that's where Coy Parrish is so good at just being an athlete and playing center field. And maybe he would have a couple more interceptions. But in this Oregon game, you think about that touchdown run where they go power. It's Coy Parrish in the hole. He gets turned around, touchdown. When you think about Coy Parrish now as a safety here through 10 games, and he's liable to have a sophomore slump, Derek, what do you think are the things that need to change in these final two games if Coy is going to end the season with a bang?
Well, the inexperience at the cornerback position that you talked about has a ripple effect on the rest of the defense, and I think that's affected the safety. The safety room is their most talented player set on defense. The defensive line has performed well, don't get me wrong, but the talent they have at safety should be the shining star of the defense, and that's been somewhat taken away by the fact that they've had to play so much man coverage. When defenses play man coverage, then your safeties have to be more involved in the run defense versus pass. So they're not able to sit back, as you pointed out, Ryan, and play center field, jump a route, get an interception, etc. They're more involved in run defense, and that hasn't been, as of yet, a strength of Coy's. Now, when he's run blitzing, I think he can be effective, but just as a run supporter, that's not been his forte. So, number one, they're playing a scheme that I don't think lends itself to his skill set as naturally. You know, the sophomore slump part of it, sure, I get that too. The other part of it is game script. You know, your safeties, if they're doing their job, and particularly if you're playing more zone, you're never going to hear from them 80% of the time. It's boring. You know, they're back, they're stopping big plays, they're not able to make these jump up plays. Where that happens is when you get a lead and the opposing offense is pressing, that's where safeties can feast, you know, where they can step in front, you can blitz them, you know, when the other team's trying to throw more. So I think it's a combination. I'm not making excuses either. I don't think he's had the second year that he would have liked to have had, but he's still the same athlete. I mean, you see when they put him in an offense, in the return game when he has an opportunity, he can shine. It's just a collection of things that I think have come together on defense has not put he or the rest of the safety group in a position to shine. Now, maybe they're doing some of the work that's more unlauded, you know, coming up and run support and making tackles for a 6-yard gain. It's not very, you're not going to get a lot of accolades when you do that. So I think it's a combination of those things, Ryan.
All right.
Any thoughts, Luke?
No, I wanted to jump to the officiating. Because it was something that was, at least I was seeing a lot of it on Twitter. It was a rough game all around. I think both sides, actually. I thought there was definitely plays that they missed that Oregon didn't benefit from. And as Gopher fans, I think in large part, you would probably make the argument. One would make the argument that, you know, Oregon doesn't need help. In these instances, I guess the one that's just still goofy to me, and I just don't understand. So I'll ask Derek, is the fumble into the end zone? Apparently, why does possession? Let me back off a tiny bit. Why, when you fumble out of bounds, not in the end zone, you have to maintain the possession in bounds, right? You know, basically like secure the process. It's not a catch per se, but you have to like secure the ball without question, right? How come in this instance you don't have to do that?
Yeah. Well, I actually, I do understand the ruling. I don't know that they interpreted it very well on the television broadcast. So he fumbles the ball, clearly fumbles the ball at the 2 yard line going in. That wasn't in question.
Right.
And the way it was explained. Yep. That's where it gets, I guess, controversial. The way that the analyst put it was, if you repossess the ball within the end zone, even for a split second, the play's over. It's a touchdown. The play's over. So the argument was, he fumbled it going in. If he puts his hands around the football for a fraction of a second in the end zone, it's a touchdown. But the problem I have, and I think you're with me on this, is I don't think he repossessed it, even for a split second.
Well, I think that's the hard part to make the determination, right? And I guess it's probably because we go back to, this is what the call was on the field, so therefore being able to overturn it is so, you have to have undisputable visual evidence or whatever the terminology is that they use. But that's the part that I struggled with. And I'm not trying to say this because like I'm upset about the specific call. I'm just kind of bewildered in general of how you officiate that very specific instance, because I don't know how you can rationalize like this whole process of a catch, right? We can get to on a different play that was end up calling it being a touchdown for Oregon. But like with you just have to maintain it for whatever an instant, right? Well, how do we define an instant?
Like, yeah, a bobble by its nature is you have possession, you don't have possession. You have possession for several instants in some case,
in
but
the
you
bobble.
Don't ultimately.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, that's where the detriment here is almost the evolution of technology, where because it was a Fox Friday night game, the 4K cameras, and you can find a specific instance in extreme slow-mo where there is possession of some kind.
Yeah.
But if you watch it in real time, it's very different. But I'm glad you brought up, Luke, the point of, because the call was what the call was on the field, I mean, it's going to be damn near impossible to overturn that.
I think it would just be interesting to ask the player in general, did you ever possess the ball, right? Like, you know, I don't know if he'll ever get asked that, but I would hope he would be honest. Like, do you think you ever possessed it? Like, I don't know. I don't know if that was me, I would have ever said I possessed it. But possession in this case is probably into the interpretation of the observer in general. So I think that's what makes that one unique. The other one would be the one along the sidelines where the toe was in. To me,
I've watched that play now, I don't know how many times. I still don't understand. Like, because I think the heel is down before the toe, and the heel's clearly out by the time he really has possession of the football. Am I missing something here?
Well, I just don't think it matters, because I don't think he completes the process.
No.
If you're looking at that, like, why weren't we looking at that? Now, again, it doesn't matter in the outcome of the game. It's to your point, the technology piece of like where we are relative to like even 10, 15 years ago and what we had a vantage point to. And, you know, they get the benefit, like the hard thing for the officials is we get the benefit of this incredible slow-mo, but like the rules have changed in terms of this. What is a catch? What isn't a catch? I don't know. One, I think Gopher Hole pointed this out. Like, how do you define toe? You can't actually see his toe. So really what you're talking about, the front of his foot was down. Using toe is an interesting terminology choice. But again, it's what's called on the field is going to be incredibly hard to overturn in general.
I just like, or even just overarching point here. It is fascinating to watch games on Sundays and games on Fridays and Saturdays. And for something like pass interference or defensive holding for secondary members, I cannot understand for the life of me how they are on different continents.
Well, there are
the way that they're called. And also, someone brought this up to me on Twitter, and I wish I could give him credit for it, but I don't remember who it was. Like, even from Big Ten refereeing crew to Big Ten refereeing crew, the inconsistencies of what is PI and what is holding and what isn't is fascinating to watch on a given week because you don't know how it's going to be called.
Okay, from my vantage point, I agree. One, thanks for the Twitter user that brought that up because I think that is part of the thing that makes it challenging as a fan is the inconsistency from crew to crew. As it relates to the NFL versus college football, you just can't compare them because they're technically different rules and how they're enforced. So I don't even try and compare them. I don't think that's fair. And even defensive holding, like the interpretation is different. So therefore, we really can't compare them from my vantage point. What I really liked, and we mentioned this on the offense, was that the Gophers were taking the kind of the conventional wisdom against man coverage, but they just couldn't get the DPIs, which seemed abundantly obvious. It was interesting to listen to Robert. Was it Robert Griffin III that was the analyst, if memory serves? The rationale that he was trying to use to say that it wasn't DPI, even though it seemed like abundantly clear it was DPI. And then you can see Minnesota's sideline just go absolutely berserk because of what they were seeing. But from a strategy standpoint, Derek, you have to throw into that. And in some ways, you have to force the defense to either try and make the play or get that DPI call.
Yeah, that's and you know that the Gophers staff going into the week anticipated that Oregon's going to play man coverage. They know, you know, especially after the scripted plays at the beginning of the game, they know when you run this formation against this personnel, this is the type of defense Oregon's going to play. And so that's a strategy. Throwing in a single coverage and getting a pass interference and will pull them out of that. That's how you, part of the reason you beat that. I think just to jump back to what you talked about, Luke, was comparing the NFL and college, it is different. The rules different. It's interpreted different. But here's the problem. Because of the way the NFL interprets the rule, it is much easier and there's a much more thick red line on what is and isn't interference. Yeah. Ryan's right. Game to game, possession to possession, crew to crew, it's different in college because in the NFL, if you touch them after 5 yards, it's either holding or pass interference. That's not the case in college. So then it becomes, well, he grabbed him, but he didn't influence his route, or he grabbed him around the waist, or he got a little bit of the jersey. But I mean, every pass is up for debate because, I mean, especially in man coverage. But it's, to me, that's, I don't know. I don't know if I'm advocating for them to adopt the NFL rule per se, but I'm just pointing out the fact that that's too much subjectivity to have to rely on. And as we've talked about in really going back to even previous years, if a defense is going to play man coverage and if they're not going to call DPI very tight, it's going to be really, really, really difficult to pass the ball on that defense. That's a huge advantage to the defense that we've talked about. Maybe the Gophers should employ that then. Say, hey, they're letting them play on the outside. Let's play press man. Let's go and grab and pull. And, you know, like if they're not going to call it, that's a huge advantage for the defense.
Well, here's Luke. I heard this on the Iowa USC broadcast yesterday, and it's going to drive home my point. Here's a suggestion for the Gopher offensive line. Heading into the USC game, do you know how many holding calls Iowa's offensive line had been called for all season?
Oh, gosh. Sub 5.
0.
Yeah.
You're telling me the Iowa offensive line all season, and they're really good, and I'm not taking that away from them.
No. Right.
But freaking 0 holds. Are you effing kidding me?
Yeah.
Derek, what is the one thing you always tell me about every run play?
You could call holding on every run play.
And Iowa hasn't had a single.
Did you hear?
Not swear here again on the podcast, but my God.
Like, did you hear, though, on the broadcast they say how many DPIs Oregon had on the season? I think they said on the season they had 6.
That's where I almost think you, I guess it's on me, the media guy who has access to Fleck. He's like, I feel like you got to like tell coaches that stuff. Like, I don't know how much that's driven home because officiating is what it is. And I know we've spent a lot of time on this and again, it wouldn't matter because Oregon's going to beat you with jimmies and joes.
Yes,
maybe
yes,
the game would have been closer for longer. I want to be very clear here. But that's where I just wish the Big Ten in general with their referees, and it's not just the Big Ten because they're having these same discussions on SEC and other podcasts too, is I would love to see them just be held accountable for some things. Look, if I have a bad podcast or I write a bad article, and Lord knows I have over the years, where even out at Oregon, I didn't even tell you guys this, I'm walking into the stadium and I talked to one of our listeners. You know what they reminded me of? They were like, hey, remember when you talked about Hank Ekpe, like he was going to be an NFL guy?
Yeah, I do.
And first of all, it is remarkable that people can remember that. Yet, but like Lord knows I've had some bad takes in 15 years of doing this, but I come on, I rectify it, I talk about it, and we move on. Like the refs had a bad game on Friday night, but there's no like, okay, well then because of that XYZ side judge or field judge is going to get demoted and they're going to bring up somebody else to do, like, there's no ramifications. It just feels like for the actions that dictate huge plays in these games. And I just wish, like, everyone hates the refs. And I know there are some, I'm sure, high school referees or college referees that are listening to this saying, you guys are idiots. We're the most, you know, we're doing our best. I do believe you're doing your best, but we all get things wrong because that's the beauty of human beings. But that's where I would love to just see if somebody has a bad game, well, guess what? They get taken off or put on a lesser game going forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm going to quickly make some comments on special teams, and then we're going to move on. Brady Denenberg made a 46-yard field goal, Ryan. Good for him. I don't have anything else on special teams.
They suck. Absolutely suck at blocking for Coy Parrish.
That's not questionable.
You know what? I'm getting to the point where, like, it's great for Brady that he did that. Like, I'm the first one to tell you, I know that I continue to read off the 40-plus yard stats, and Lord knows they're going to need a 40-plus yard field goal the next 2 weeks where it's going to be the first one to 20 wins. And I hope that Brady comes through like he did in Oregon, and that's great for him. But the blocking schemes and execution in front of Coy Parrish in the punt and kick return game, I encourage you, for those of you who are going to be watching at 11 a.m. on BTN, or we'll see what the Wisconsin game is, Coy Parrish is dynamic. It just doesn't matter because he's got to make four guys miss instead of one guy miss. And until they can have someone not named Derek LeCaptain or Mason Carrier block in front of him, let's move on.
All right. Do you guys want to talk through some Big Ten games, or do you just want to call it?
No, I want to talk about Northwestern, the next opponent, finding a way to lose a football game. And here's the thing I posed to Justin Gard this morning, and I'm going to ask the same thing of the two of you. The Gophers had no hope heading into halftime. You're down 28-6. Would you rather lose that way as a fan, or would you rather lose the way Northwestern did, where they were +5? That is a plus sign in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the take give and lose on a walk-off field goal in Wrigley Field. Which one would you rather have, Luke?
Loss on the walk-off field goal. It's more entertaining.
Derek?
I would much rather know it by the middle of the first quarter that there's no chance.
I'd be much more angry if I lost +5 than I would be you just got Jimmy and Joe.
Yeah, but I just spent 3 hours, and at least I was entertained the entire time. Okay, but we digress. In that game, just to real quick, Michigan won 24-22. They hit a last second field goal, like you said, Ryan. What was crazy is Michigan seemed like they were in the lead, and then the turnover show started, Derek.
Yeah, it was. If Northwestern's offense had put together two or three first downs on any one of the final five possessions, Michigan loses, Northwestern wins. So this was as much about Northwestern's inability to just possess the football for any length of time in the final five possessions as it was about Michigan repeatedly turning it over. One of the things that is entertaining, I'll give you this, Luke, is college football is, that's why you watch on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. I mean, these games are Northwestern, I'm not trying to pump them up because the Gophers are playing them. They're the most improved Big Ten team from first, in my opinion, from the first half to second half of the season. I'm not saying they're a fantastic team. You know, certainly talent-wise, they're not really there, but it's classic Northwestern. They usually don't make a lot of mistakes. They can run the ball. They can block fairly well, but they hung in there the whole game with a pretty decent ranked Michigan team. So at a quasi neutral site, Wrigley Field. So yeah, that was an entertaining game one way or another. I don't know, depending on who you're pulling for, I guess whether you were happy or not when it ended, but that was, you watch because you can say, I haven't seen one like that before.
All right.
Hold on. We got to keep going here because if you just look at the stats, Luke, in Michigan out yards them nearly 2-1. They had 496 yards to 245, but it was the turnovers.
Yes.
That game should have been Michigan by 17 points. But Michigan also missed two field goals, five turnovers. I will tell you, we also get to get Narrative Street next week because Luke's favorite former Gopher right tackle,
Martez Lewis, yeah,
the starter for the Northwestern Wildcats at that position. But it's just the Northwest. Like, I hope people are ready to watch the RPO back into their lives, because whether it's Preston Stone running it for Northwestern or Carter Smith, who is now the true freshman quarterback who's running it for the Wisconsin, we're going to find out if the Gophers can stop the RPO in the next 2 weeks.
All right. UCLA lost in Columbus 48-10. I think the wonderful, you know, redemption tour or narrative that was move on from Foster and, you know, find hope has finally kind of crashed and burned. And Ohio State's just really good. I guess nobody has comments on that game. That's fine.
What do you say at this point other than Ohio State's a buzzsaw?
Yeah.
UCLA's quarterback didn't play in that game, but I guess Ohio State found a run game because they ran for 222 yards and four scores. Like, Ohio State is just playing with their opponents. And even next week against Rutgers, like, what are we really going to learn in that game? I think it's undetermined yet. But it's, can Ohio State finish off the buzzsaw season against Michigan in Ann Arbor, where Ryan Day in 2 weeks has not just, I mean, everybody knows it. So I'm going to be fascinated to see that one.
Okay. Wisconsin lost 31-7 against Indiana. It was close at halftime, 10-7, but Indiana was able to rip off 21 points in the second half and win convincingly again, Derek.
Yeah, Wisconsin, I was impressed with their defense against what has been a juggernaut of an Indiana offense in at least the first 2.5 quarters. They really bowed their back. That's Wisconsin. If they have a strength this year, that's Wisconsin's strength, is their defense. But ultimately, Indiana made enough adjustments, and it's just wild to say, you know, Indiana only scoring 31 points is probably a somewhat of a victory. I mean, being that they're, you know, they go 50 plus in a lot of these games, but you know, Wisconsin couldn't hang in there ultimately for four quarters, but you're right, it was close for 2.5.
Right. Wisconsin is also now on like running back 14 because their starter Gideon, I think Atuka, he got hit and carted off. I mean, they're banged up everywhere. It's just, I wish I could watch Indiana's pass catchers every week, because even without Elijah Surratt, like, something called Charlie Becker was incredible in this game. Like, they just, not only is it Heisman contender Fernando Mendoza, who completed all but two passes for four touchdowns and 299 yards, those Indiana receivers don't get enough love to go with their Heisman quarterback.
All right, number 21, Iowa lost 26-21 in Southern California against USC. This game featured Iowa scoring 21 points in the first half and yet somehow finding a way to lose. This is the kind of thing that doesn't really make sense, Derek. I know there are some controversial calls that Iowa fans would point to that really would have helped them in this specific game, but in the end, USC was able to do just enough to pull this game off.
Yeah, two things that really shocked me from this game, which was also entertaining, was Iowa gave up a big lead. When's the last time that's happened? Usually their boa constrictor style of play is if they get up two scores, you got no chance. And then secondly, I thought that USC, made much better adjustments in the second half than Iowa, which, again, when is the last time you've seen an opponent do that to Iowa? Usually it's the opposite. As Iowa goes in the locker room, they figure it out, they tinker with three or four things, and they come out and win the second half. USC flipped that script on them completely. They won the second half. And the controversial call, the irony here is final possession, Iowa has a pass on fourth down, I believe. That same type of situation that we talked about where the Oregon defender caught it in the end zone, it was ruled a touchdown. Iowa Iowa receiver catches the ball going out of bounds. It's ultimately ruled out of bounds. His toe is right on the line, maybe in the line, on the line, whatever. This one doesn't go the way of the offense, in this case, Iowa, and that's the end of the game.
All right.
Hold on. Two thoughts. One, okay. Mekhi Lemon is awesome, and he's got to be a first-team All-Big Ten receiver. With the way that he made contested catch after contested catch for 10 receptions for 153 yards and a score, he was awesome. I'd also tell you the Iowa Hawkeyes now have the same record as Minnesota. Yeah,
crazy.
Is Minnesota their best win?
Probably.
That or Penn State?
Yeah, and Penn State, you know, rips off their first Big Ten victory. Penn State moves to 4-6. They still have a chance to be bowl eligible, folks. They had 28 points to Michigan State's 10. Again, they scored 14 in the fourth quarter to put this thing away. There are two now teams that don't have a win in Big Ten play. That would be Michigan State and Purdue. I don't know if either of you got a chance to watch any of this game, but I think the interesting thing is that Penn State has a chance to be bowl eligible and now has one Big Ten victory.
Katron Allen got going in that game. I can tell you that definitively. The other thing I'll be curious is Penn State now has to take on Nebraska in Happy Valley. What do you think the line on that game is?
I would bet it's around a field goal. Probably.
Which way do you think?
Probably Nebraska field goal.
I would say Penn State 3.
Okay.
Minus 3.
Penn State minus 7.
Really?
Is the opening line on that one.
Really? Okay.
Actually, I lied. As we sit here Sunday morning, FanDuel has it Penn State minus 9.5.
Okay.
Already.
Wow.
Jeepers creepers. I know Raiola's out, but that is a very fascinating line.
And we've talked about it. I think Luke brought it up. Nebraska maybe looks at times better
without
their
Raiola.
Backup quarterback. Yeah.
I mean, we'll see when they have a game. They have a week to game plan. But okay, Maryland lost to Illinois at Illinois 24-6. Illinois moves to 7-3, 4-3 in the Big Ten, and they're low key kind of a scary team, guys. I still think that Illinois is not getting enough credit given the tough schedule that they've had.
I mean, we're talking about a team with losses to Indiana, Ohio State, and on the road in Washington, where Washington is a ranked team at home and they're an abomination on the road. I agree. And you look at the next couple of weeks, and there's no team that Gopher fans are going to want to root for more next weekend, other than the Golden Gophers, is the Illinois Fighting Illini, who I'm going to be sitting in a bar with some of our listeners watching, because it's going to be a night game for Brett Bielema's return to Camp Randall next weekend. So you want that game to go 14 overtimes, everybody get banged up before the Axe game the following weekend. And Illinois is a very physical football team. They didn't have it offensively in this one, but you're hoping that this is a good old-fashioned slobber knocker in Camp Randall this upcoming weekend.
I got to give credit to the Illinois coaching staff, where in the first half of the season, their defense was absolutely atrocious, and they've really figured it out. This game in particular, Ryan mentioned that their offense wasn't particularly good for Illinois, but this was, I think, a single-digit score for both teams deep into the second half, or at least into the second half. So Illinois has clearly figured something out on defense. They've got them coached up, and as I always give credit to Brett Bielema, they can win multiple different ways. They can win low-scoring, high-scoring, single-possession game, whatever. So, you look at the record and who they've lost to, and I do think they're a little bit more dangerous than I think people are giving them credit for.
All right. A Big Ten win still eludes Purdue as Washington wins 49-13. Not particularly close, as Washington had a 28-0 halftime lead. They scored Purdue scored 10 late in the fourth in garbage time. But again, this game wasn't close at all, fellas.
Washington is just a different team at home, and they're a different team on the West Coast, where next weekend they get to travel to UCLA to take on that team, and before they host your favorite Oregon team at the end of the season. Can I get the Luke Buehler prediction for where is Jed Fish coaching by the time mid-December comes around?
Where is he coaching? Oh, mid-December. So the season will be over. Rumor is UCLA.
I'm going to say Florida.
Okay. I mean, in keeping in the history of Jed Fish, he seems to move about every 2 years or a year, so it would make sense for him to move on. But
Derek, are you coming to Wrigley next weekend?
No, I won't be there.
You know, one day we're going to meet each other, Derek.
That's well. Yeah, I know. I heard you're going to be there, so I can't go.
Yeah, that's the rub.
All right, I think that'll probably do it for this episode. The final two games are going to be fun, and Northwestern and Wisconsin are probably two of the most improved teams as the season has gone on. Go ahead.
Did I give you guys what the line is, the early line for Gophers Northwestern?
I got to think that it's Northwestern by 5.
Derek?
No, I'm going to say Minnesota by 1.5.
Northwestern -3 with an over-under of 40.5 per FanDuel. So Vegas is thinking something like 21-17 type of deal. And that's going to be the theme the next 2 weeks is I can already tell you for Wednesday, Luke, I'm going to be taking the under for both field condition and what these two teams are. First one of 20 wins the next 2 weeks. Should be a good one.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys all for listening. Looking forward to the last two games as we close this out. Your Gophers are 6-4. They still have an opportunity to beat the Vegas odds of 6.5 wins on the season. And, you know, if both these could go their way, they'd end up with an 8-win season. That's kind of truly incredible given what we've seen on the roads thus far, but they have to do it. Again, thanks for listening, and go Gophers.